Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 210 for comics originally released on August 17th, 2011. Now, starting us off in DC is Green Lantern Corps number 63. This is the final issue of this volume of Green Lantern Corps. With the relaunch, we're of course going to get New Green Lantern, New Green Lantern Corps, Green Lantern New Guardians, and Red Lanterns. So, this is one of those franchises that, as far as we can tell, we're being told isn't really going to change all that much. And this was really essentially a done-in-one issue, a couple of short stories about the Green Lanterns facing kind of a crisis of faith after the events of the War of the Green Lanterns. And, you know, it's told in quote-unquote chapters, but really it's a couple of short stories strung together with one at the end to sort of tie them all off. And I liked the issue, but man, it didn't live up to the solicitation. You know, it seemed like there was going to be a shattering series conclusion, a big crisis in Sector 2813 for them to face and all this kind of stuff, and really this issue wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, in terms of it not living up to the solicitation and in what happened in it.
I tend to not remember the solicitations, you know, so I came into this one fresh, but boy, I haven't gotten to all of the DC conclusions yet. I'm still waiting for the one that's the whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow of, you know, this batch. Because the ending was, I mean, it was just, it wasn't, you know, like you were expecting because you saw it in the solicit. I was kind of expecting it just because, you know, I'm waiting for DC to do some kind of conclusion that's like a really good conclusion that, you know, you remember and you're talking about, wow, you know, they really ended that series on a great note. Now, maybe I'll get that when I read Titans 100, because, you know, that last Titans, you know, we talked about the Titans issue
Teen Titans, right.
I forget there's Titans and Teen Titans, because I dropped the regular Titans title. But, you know, Teen Titans, you know, that one looks like it could potentially be building up to something like that. And I saw the comic in the comic shop. I didn't pick it up and look at it or anything, but it's, you know, like a double size thing, and you know, that one's got potential.
Have you read issue 99 of Teen Titans?
Yes.
At the end of it, it really sets up what's going to happen in the 100
right.
and stuff, and it does look like it's going to be the big showdown, kind of again like that Man of Tomorrow kind of a thing. The other one that kind of stood out as kind of bit more of an unusual ending story was Justice League, in which basically James Robinson, the writer, goes through almost like a recap of the next 2 years' worth of stories he was set to tell. Oh, remember when this happened, and just kind of flashes through. They did this. And I was thinking, you know, if he hadn't dragged out the Eclipso storyline and one or two others so long so they would fit in a trade, and done a lot of those more as like a one or two part kind of a thing, the ideas he had I thought were really great. It could have been some awesome done in one, done in two type stories, and made that run of the Justice League feel like they just did a lot.
Yeah, I have not even read the Eclipso stuff from Justice League. I lost interest in Justice League when it essentially became, you know, new teen, you know, Perez
area, newer new teen titans.
Newer Teen Titans or something. It's just, it wasn't the Justice League, and that's like piled up in my to-read pile. I really wanted to try to wrap myself up on the DC series before all the DC relaunch. That gives me about 2 weeks, so I have to get cracking on that.
Yeah. Well, I'm current on all the DC stuff, including everything that came in the shipment. And with this Green Lantern Corps 63, it was not a bad issue, and I really liked what they were trying to do here with exploring how the recent events impacted some of the various Green Lanterns and stuff. But there was a little bit of kind of that marking time aspect to this issue with, well, we need to put another issue out, but can't really do a whole lot, you know. And when I open it up and I've got the chapter one, and I'm like, I know this is a done-in-one story, guys. So typically the chapter thing is you know, issue one of X versus, you know, five-page mini-story one of X.
Well, I mean, it looks like they're setting some stuff up. I mean, it's like the Green Lanterns, a lot of them are, you know, oh, humans, we don't like humans. You guys think you're so special, bunch of humans in the core, and there's, you know, no other race that's got, you know, four or five Green Lanterns running around. And then you have the other Lanterns who are, you know, we're sick of the Guardians and we can't work for guys that are like letting Sinestro run around, you know. And
they're definitely building up the friction within the core.
Right.
And they did a good job of that here, no question about that. But it's a question of if they're kind of condensing the backstory of the DC Universe with the relaunch, is this really going to pick up right on the heels? And it probably will. But it's going to be curious for me to see how they try to have their cake and eat it too. Try to clean up the backstory on some titles while maintaining the backstory on some other titles. It's a tough thing to do.
Well, and especially with the relaunch, I kind of have a feeling like, and I have no idea how they're going to go with it, but I mean, we do know that Sinestro is going to be the main Green Lantern in one of the titles that comes out. And starting the whole thing off with a lot of this friction that they're building up, I mean, we just had a lot of stuff going on with Blackest Night. We've had the War of the Green Lanterns, you know, with Krona taking all these people over and stuff. And just seems to me like it's about time to do some straight heroic stuff and not be dragging me back down into a bunch of internal Green Lantern politics. And that's what this issue had way too much of that. And I hope that that's not setting it up so that after the relaunch, there's just going to be a lot of this internal power struggle junk, because I'm not that big a fan of that right now.
Well, it's interesting you phrase it that way, because what immediately comes to mind is with the relaunch, it's like, again, starting a new TV show or a new season of a TV show. And I think you're right. They should, with the new Green Lantern number ones of the different titles and stuff, and Red Lantern 2, it should read as if it's a cosmic cop drama. And typically a cop drama on TV or whatever, you don't see the different squads of police officers fighting amongst themselves or at war with each other or whatever. They're going and they're catching cops.
Yeah, you might have some little conflicts creep into it over time as you set them up. But, I mean, again, since theoretically the new issues are going to be jumping on points for all these new readers if they're successful, right?
Yeah.
You got to think of it that way, right? And not throw people into the middle of some existing power struggle. So part of me is kind of hoping that a lot of the stuff here is really not set up, because I don't really want to see this stuff played out over the next year.
Yeah, and again, as far as this issue goes, it wasn't a bad issue, it just wasn't a great issue. I mean, for me, it was a very solid 3 out of 5. Nothing wrong with it, but nothing that made me think, oh, wow. And it places things in an interesting position for the relaunch. And I really hope DC comes out of the gate telling clean stories that don't have a huge need of backstory and stuff like that, and that they're really good jumping on points and can get people excited about, in this case, Green Lantern, and in other cases, the other properties.
Right. That's exactly where it was for me. Now, one other thing I wanted to comment on, this cover was really non-dynamic. I mean, everyone's like kind of like moping around, hanging their head. It's like, oh, you know, all shades of green. It's very darkly colored. You know, it's almost like, you know, your dog died. You know?
Yeah, kind yeah.
Of, it's just like,
there's
wow.
A definite mourning aspect to that in a bad way, yeah. Well, what's interesting is some of these characters really weren't even in the issue. I would like to see covers
pretty
going
unremarkable.
Yeah, I'd like to see covers going forward be more evocative of what's in the issue, more dynamic, and do a better job selling that issue. Because there's nothing in that cover that made me think, wow, I've got to go read that issue.
I mean, that cover, if I was looking at comics on the rack, picking them off, and I wasn't already buying this series, I would not pick up and buy this comic book based on this cover. You want to move on to Marvel?
Yeah.
X-Men Schism, issue 3 of 5. Now, this one is kind of interesting because I picked up Schism number 1 because I think I got the sketch cover. To, you know, bring the sketch cover to con. And I read it, and I actually, you know, it was unusual for me in that it was an X-Men book that didn't feel like I was walking in on the middle of a soap opera that had been going on for 20 years with all kinds of references to stuff that I had no idea about. I mean, I kind of knew who the different people were. Aaron did a good job of setting the things up. And, you know, that continued through issue 2. I don't know that the rotating artist every issue is working that great for me. We had Carlos Pacheco on the first issue. You had Frank Cho on the second issue. Now you got Daniel Acuna on this one. And the Daniel Acuna art, while I like him on, I've liked him on other things, it wasn't really working for me in this particular issue. And another thing, in the previous couple of issues, this one little kid, the Kilgore kid, I was okay with that. Okay, it's, you got this one little kid, what is he, like 10 or something, and he's a remarkable kid, and he's taken over the Hellfire Club, becoming the new Black King, you know, etc., etc., and he's going to show the mutants what for. I was okay with that. It was stretching my credibility, but, you know, I got people turning to ice and, you know, flying around and shooting optic beams and stuff, so I can kind of roll with a 10-year-old master criminal. This issue, Aaron introduces the League of 10-year-olds, you know, and it's like all of a sudden we've got all these little kids sitting around the table, and it really broke my suspension of disbelief.
I believe they'd actually been introduced in the second issue. We get a better, not in the same way, but they were shown as being part of the deal when they were brokering with, I guess, the aliens or whatever. And they were shown as being pretty fierce in the girl's case, almost like a martial arts expert or whatever. So we didn't get them by name, we didn't get them by backstory, but we certainly got them set up as, you know, key players. They seemed a little bit more, I don't say like henchmen, but like lieutenants or whatever, which is kind of sort of how they're used here. But it does seem odd that a lot of the threats of the Marvel Universe these days, and in Amadeus Cho's one of the heroes, are these preteen or young teen characters of incredible intellect, cunning, and, you know, savagery in some cases. It's kind of weird.
So, I mean, it didn't strike me the wrong way last issue, however you used them. And when I got to this sitting around the table, you know, months ago scene, and, you know, then when I've got, you know, all of them. And, you know, the other thing is, you've got some heavy hitters here. I mean, Namor has been a pretty fierce guy for 60, 70 years. You know, fights the Fantastic Four to a standstill by himself. And this 10-year-old kid is like, oh, let me shoot a heat beam at your wings on your ankle. And he, like, goes down. It's like, okay. You know, I don't know. It's just, this issue really didn't work for me.
I see where you're coming from on this.
And I know they're setting it up for them to triumph or something, but it just, I wasn't buying it.
Well, I read all three of these back-to-back, and I thought this miniseries really put kind of the human versus mutants problem front and center, and in a good way. And they do this periodically of, yes, we're feared and oppressed, but sometimes they go to the extremes like they do who are really showing it. And that in this case, with only, I mean, less than 200 or so mutants left in the world, humanity is still pretty afraid of these guys. And given what Kid Omega does, I guess, in that first issue, there's good reason for humanity to be fearful of mutants. You know, you've got, you know, Cyclops who can stare somebody down and kill them literally with his beams and stuff. So I get the paranoia and the fear. And the rotating art teams, I mean, I'm liking the art. This issue less so than the other two, because, I mean, again, you know, Pacheco, Cho, I mean, those guys are great. But back to back with these issues, it seemed like, particularly in this one, the art style was so different, it was a little annoying. In one of them, I think it might have been the Cho issue, Cyclops was drawn really skinny, taking that Slim nickname literally. And it used to be literal, but, I mean, Cyclops has been, you know, with the X-Men for half his life or whatever. It's hard to tell. He's been hunted by Sentinels since he was 16. I'm placing him at around 30-ish. Maybe that's a little high. But he's had time to get in shape, and these days he's not slim, which is why Wolverine keeps using that nickname. But anyways, the art here, not so great. It was one of those things that I'm kind of thinking that the schism this is leading up to, we know it's going to divide the X-Men back into two camps. I'm thinking it's going to be kind of the classic, you know, Professor X, let's live with humanity, Magneto, let's make humanity, you know, push back when they're pushing on us, kind of a more aggressive stance. And I think that more militant group is going to be led by Cyclops, and what's interesting is what I would put more as the live and let live group, or the more pacifistic group in comparison, that's the one I think Wolverine's going to lead. Because while Wolverine is indeed being very aggressive here, typically when he's being aggressive, it's towards the mutants who are going wrong, going back to Professor X's policing of the mutant community, versus a lot of what, you know, Cyclops is doing is more of an aggressive stance towards humanity. And it's showing kind of how the Cyclops has evolved over time, and Wolverine for that matter too, but also just within these couple of issues and Generation Hope number 10, they really show the evolution of Idy, of that new group of mutants, who has a very definite turning point here. And this, the events in this issue, which are expanded on a lot in the Generation Hope, because it's telling kind of her part of this issue from her perspective and in detail, that's got to have a profound impact on that character and the X-Men just in general. So I think some of what they did there to build up that character's relationship with Wolverine, with kind of her arc through these couple of issues, I thought was really well done. And if you go to...
It's all lost on me since I don't read any of those other books. But
well, if you go to three pages after the staple, there's a scene there that happens. And the events of all of that and kind of what's going on and stuff there, that's what Generation Hope number 10 focuses entirely on.
Okay.
And it actually gave a bit better of a kind of an end cap or whatever to her part of the story that really put a very kind of a creepy spin on it.
I mean, I don't know who this character is. I mean, I see her shooting like what looks like an ice blast out of one hand and a fire blast out of the other hand. I just kind of rolled with it. But I have no idea who this character is or what her backstory is.
And I don't think you do. All you need to know is she's a young mutant.
Right. And that's all that I took out of it. It's like I didn't have a problem with her part of the issue. It's like she's a young mutant, Wolverine has a certain take on her, Cyclops has another take on her. I can see even just how they're interacting with her, setting up that rift between the two of them, right?
Yeah.
And that's all I took out of it, you know, but I didn't mind that, you know. I didn't feel like, I mean, I didn't feel like I needed to run out and learn more about her.
The following page where she's like coming out of there and Wolverine and Cyclops encounter her, that played out differently in Generation Hope, and I think much more effectively there. So that's one that, as part of the schism event, I think is worth reading because it really... it goes back to kind of the difference between, or the equivalent of to of what's happening here to the difference between how Professor X was grooming mutants and how Magneto back then was grooming mutants. Professor X more as a defensive force to help people and protect people. Magneto more as an offensive attack force, you know, kind of a thing. And the question comes down to these days, under Cyclops, at Utopia, how are the younger mutants being groomed and trained, and how do they perceive how they're being groomed and trained? And very much here, you know, Wolverine was doing the don't send her in, you know, I'm almost there, and Cyclops is doing the, well, we got to send her in, she's there, kind of a... And it's a very interesting dynamic, because there are times, even in the very recent past, with the beginning of Uncanny X-Force and stuff like that, where Wolverine has been classically the more militant, more attacking of the two. And it's, to me, it's a very interesting dynamic there. And it's going to be curious, you know, to see which mutants side with which camp, if it even breaks down this way. And it may not. It may break down along other lines or whatever. But to see how they split out the 200 or so mutants, where the different ones get based and all that. And I think they're doing a good job setting up a very real point of friction between Wolverine and Cyclops that's been there for a while, but putting it to a head such that it can no longer be ignored.
Well, I know that, and I'm looking, he's 12 years old, not 10. So I apologize, Cade Kilgore, for taking 2 years away from you, calling you a 10-year-old. That was wrong of me.
It was flattering of you, because that way it made it seem like he'd accomplished so much and so much faster.
Yeah. This one other scene here that really bothered me in this issue, and that's the scene where they've defeated all of these guys, you know, including Magneto, by the way. So not only do they take out Namor ridiculously easily, they take out Magneto, who is like fought off, like, you know, half the heroes in the Marvel Universe at a time before. And Aaron feels compelled to work in this "it's better than sex" joke for a 12-year-old. You know, I haven't had sex yet, so maybe I'm wrong, but I can't imagine it feeling better than this. And it's like, that completely took me out of the story. And like, you know, really? You want to put that joke into the mouth of a 12-year-old? You know, that was really bad, in my opinion. My basic point is like, I was really excited about this series up through issue 2, and he lost me completely on this issue.
Well, there is a matter of just how quickly, you know, Colossus, Iceman, Emma Frost, some of these characters go down just almost with a single shot.
Exactly.
And really, these X-Men are some of the heavy hitters. You know, it's not Cyclops, it's not Wolverine, but really, once you get past those two, Magneto, Namor, Emma Frost, those are very heavy hitters. You could argue Colossus and Iceman either way is not necessarily the definitive heavy hitters, but still up to that. And really, the fight lasts 3 pages, 4 pages maybe, once you get back and cut in. And every other mutant there, of which there are a lot of the younger ones, rifle butt to the head, boom, they're down. So I definitely don't think this was the strongest of the series so far, but I felt the other issues were really strong. I enjoyed this. I liked a lot of what they were doing. I would give this personally a low 4. And I recommend reading that issue of Generation Hope, because I really think it puts a good spin on some of the events here, and really gives it a lot more power to those events than we get in this issue. And it's unfortunate that what seems to be a pivotal event here, you know, is told better elsewhere.
I gave the first couple of issues of this series high 4s. Mm-hmm. This one, like, a medium 3. You know, it really lost me, this issue. And, you know, I went from being really excited about maybe starting to read some X-Men stuff to maybe I don't need to, after all, with this issue.
Well, I think the X-Men
are not necessarily a good thing.
The X-Men are a hard sell for you, and part of it is Like, we were talking about this character. You're like, well, I don't know who she is or what she can do or why she's a character.
That actually didn't bother me that much, though. It was the characterization and usage of the mutants that I did know
right.
that I had a huge problem with in this issue.
My point is, you diving back into the X-Men corner of the Marvel Universe is a hard sell because it's so soap operatic and has so many characters, and they do really not that strong of a job of reestablishing characters that they feel are mainstays of the X-Men corner of the universe, but people outside not reading those titles wouldn't know from anyone else, kind of a thing. It's going to be interesting to see what the reaction is to the storyline in trade, where the issues are back-to-back and the art style jumps from issue to issue.
I'll just say, Idy, she's going to be the next great thing because she did better against these guys than Emma Frost, Magneto, and Namor put together. So she's got something going on.
Yeah, well, read Generation Hope number 10. It puts a very...
Is that the one that just has a big Idy head on the cover?
That's the one.
I saw it at the store.
It really focuses on her side of events and her perspective on things of what happens in that issue. And I thought was probably the best issue of that series. Not that that's saying a whole lot. It's only 10 issues old, and some of the stuff has been kind of average. Shall we move on to our other book for the week?
Sure. We've got The One from GG Studios, number 5. This is a kind of a sword and sandals kind of a... I hesitate to say sword, and I don't know if there's a lot of magic going on in it, but maybe there is. It's kind of one of these barbarian kind of medieval kind of thing set in another world stories, focusing mostly on these female warrior characters as some of the main characters in it. So you get lots of cheesecakey art with the, women with swords, and they're doing all kinds of wonderful, kind of stuff. They're not to be trifled with. This is definitely in the fantasy camp, and I think this is kind of ones that I'm guessing is kind of a hard sell with you because you're not that big of a fantasy fan. And this one really, for me, kicks it up a notch in the fantasy side because of the setting that it's in. It's one of the fantasy kind of things. And I don't remember if we talked about this series on an older episode or we just talked about it on the forum. But one of the things that's kind of a hallmark of this series to me is that it's one of the kinds of fantasy that you have lots of really high fantasy kind of names for everything. No one's got a regular name. It's like Hagjadi, Faras, and it's like they're all, making their exclamations, by Rar, and they're talking a lot about the, the lofty, perilous Renheron Eastern Woods. And, everything has got one of these high fantasy kind of names attached to it. And I think that makes it even more difficult for someone who's not really into, that whole fantasy thing to get into the flow of the story. Now, let's see how accurate I am in that assessment by tossing it over to you.
Well, I mean, yeah, this is something that I had originally checked out because, I'm liking a lot of what GG Studio is doing. And the art here is good, the story here is good, but I'd pretty much lost interest in the series already. And this was the last issue I had on pre-order. And a lot of that is not a reflection of the title so much as my minimal interest in kind of the fantasy genre. I mean, this is a good but not great title in my opinion, and that's more from a perspective of it's good but not great enough to stay on my rather full reading list. A lot of it just comes down to, for whatever reasons, I'm not connecting with the material. The names aren't memorable, the events aren't memorable to me, and again, this is something where like you said, it's a bit of a hard sell for me. The title isn't bad, it's just not clicking for me. And there are a couple of things that I think are not helping it for me. The speech patterns are some of it. The names are some of it, making it hard for me to remember, you know, the character names and whatnot. And this may seem really picky, but the word balloons, small font, the font seems a little smaller than average, a little less bolder than average. The octagonal or whatever
angular nature of them.
Nature yeah. of it seems just a little off from what I'm used to. And again, there's nothing wrong with this. This is good stuff. They're telling a good story, but it's not the kind of story I tend to gravitate towards. So for me, this was a perfectly average issue. I mean, it was a solid 3. Certainly, there's nothing wrong about the story they're doing or the execution of the story, but because it's not one that I'm particularly interested in, it's not something I see the need to continue forward with.
Yeah, I mean, it's the genre of the subgenre of this kind of fantasy, because there are stories set in fantasy worlds like this that, even if they have some of the naming and conventions like this one has, do it slightly less to a point where, I mean, I'm reading it and I'm fine with following it because I read a lot of fantasy stuff and I really like fantasy and I like this kind of genre. But even as I'm reading it, I'm kind of noticing, wow, you know, they have a lot of, you know, references to really crazy place names. And, you know, I've read other fantasy stuff where they have made up place names, but the place names roll off the tongue a little easier and are a little more memorable. And I just, what's good about it is they at least put that map in the back, you know, which is always good when you have a fantasy story like this on a fantasy world, when they put a map. I personally always like that, but I find myself, you know, looking back at that map a lot while I'm going through the story. And again, you know, the people's names are to the point where, you know, everybody has got, you know, these kind of names, you know, even when you're reading Lord of the Rings, you know, hey, you know, Gandalf, Aragorn, you know, Frodo, these are not normal names, but you can pronounce them. They're two syllables, you know, they're kind of memorable. And even though I like this story in particular, I really like the art. I like, you know, the story that's being told. I find myself having a little bit of a hard time with these kinds of facets of the story also, you know, and maybe it's, you know, just, you know, some of the choices. And it's not originally English, you know, it's from, is it from France or Italy? I forget. But, you know, maybe, you know, and I don't think you translate the names necessarily. And maybe the names in whatever the original language are a little more memorable or, you know, stick a little better or something. You know, for me, I have a little bit of a hard time with the names. Not that it makes me not want to read the story, but again, I have that predisposition towards the genre. You know, so I think that's the big difference. And I would say I recommend this story to people who like fantasy comics. And, you know, there's not that many fantasy comics out there. If you're kind of on the fence about fantasy, there are other ones that are a little easier to get into, you know. So I would recommend this title for people who really like fantasy comics.
I guess for me, there's some other aspect that's coming into play, because, I mean, there are a couple of fantasy titles that I really like that were in this horseback, you know, with swords and that kind of a setting. I'm thinking specifically Sojourn over at CrossGen. I loved that series, and that was more fantastical in many respects. It actually had magic. It actually had, you know, trolls, goblins, and those sorts of things.
But I never had a problem with Arwen, Mordath, Gareth, and again, there's certain things, and even there's something about the naming in this that it just, for me, it's not as easy to deal with.
I agree with your point on the naming and that is acting a little bit as a barrier to entry for me for remembering the characters and getting attached to the characters. My point is, aside from that, which is a valid issue, I think there's something else about the nature of fantasy stories that attracts me to something like Sojourn and does not attract me to something like this. And I'm not sure what that is.
You know, Sojourn was a lot more like a standard comic book story, I think. You know, when you read and you looked at the art in Sojourn and you looked at the panel-to-panel storytelling in Sojourn and the coloring and, you know, the whole thing, it flowed like a more standard comic. And this one doesn't as much.
I think the other difference is something like Sojourn has very clear, definitive lead characters, whereas here they're telling a broader canvas kind of a story. We've got the machinations back at the palace, we've got the things in war, we've got a lot of characters, and this is much more of a huge ensemble kind of a thing, which just adds to the amount of characters to kind of get marginally attached to, and because there's so many, it's hard to stay too attached to anyone's, because, I mean, there's quite a bit of characters, you know, getting killed off in this issue. So I think part of it is the difference in scope. This is a bit more epic in scope than something like a Sojourn, and that in and of itself, I think, is part of what made it harder for me to connect to this material. There was no particular character that I felt I really latched on to.
I do think visually, though, the art, which, again, is part of it that's interesting to me, is very non-standard comic book art, which is just another...
It's a more European flair, you know, so there are different layouts. There are a lot of pages that have panels that stretch the entire width of the page, and there's like five of them stacked, giving it a bit more of a cinematic widescreen kind of a feel, which typically you don't get in an American comic. So there's also that kind of difference in the visual language of the comic, like you're talking about there, between, again, the more European style and a more American style. And there's nothing wrong with that, but that too acts as a little bit of a, not a barrier to entry, but a subconscious friction point for me. Of I'm used to stories, like you said, Sojourn is told in a very American way because it was an American comic. Whereas here, there are things that are doing that are perfectly valid, perfectly clear, but I don't want to say feel unnatural, but are different enough than what I'm used to that it's not working in the favor of the series for me.
Yeah, and I just finished rereading all the Atlas comics, right? And there'll be an Atlas episode that goes up at some point in the future, back from the 70s. And there were two kind of fantasy comics in that run. There was Iron Jaw and there was Wolf the Barbarian. And they both had kind of fantasy-ish themes, and they had, you know, the different kind of naming and all this kind of elements. Both of them were more similar to a Sojourn, you know, kind of thing than they were to this. And again, it might be the American storytelling style versus the more European, which, again, it's not a bad thing, but I can see kind of like a visual language of the comic that, you know, you can easily draw connector points between those things. And if you've read, you know, like Claw the Unconquered, Conan, Kull, you know, any of these kinds of comics, there's commonality points that you're not necessarily getting here, but the fact that I'm not getting those here is one of the things that makes this an interesting book to me, because it does have that European flair to it, I think, that's just a different kind of storytelling that is refreshing, and I like seeing
and
just
certainly
a different way of getting the story. But I think you made a really good point, and that is the scope of this story. Again, when I look at any of those other ones that I'm talking about, you got Sojourn, it like focuses on Arwen and her little group of people. You know, you look at, you know, Conan or Red Sonja or Wolf or Iron Jaw, or any of those kind of things, there's this more character focused thing, whereas this certainly does have a wider scope to it. And,
yeah,
and
you don't have the lead characters, the companions, and the clear adventure that they're on. Here, they're kind of telling this again, this epic story. And I certainly don't want anyone to think that I'm saying that the European style of this is bad or a negative or anything. It's making it harder for me to connect, but I agree with what you're saying, that by having that European style to it, it makes it much more unique in the American comic market, and I think that is a huge asset. There are going to be people who gravitate towards that, people who gravitate away from that, but these days I think having something that is definitively different stylistically and for particular reasons and stuff, and in this case they're doing it for all the right reasons because it naturally came from Europe and stuff, I see that as a huge benefit to the series.
No, I agree, and it the art really is the main sell on this for me. I mean, I like the story fine, but I really like the art. You know, it's just, again, it's one of those, when I'm reading a lot of comics, you read a lot of comics, I read a lot of comics, it's one of those kind of things for me that's kind of like a palate cleanser. You know, you hear about the people on the food shows that, you know, they are tasting the different kind of foods, and then they have some little thing that kind of cleanses their palate and lets them, you know, look kind of fresh. This one is like that. It is different, and it just as refreshing as a change up from, you know, so many other books that, even if they're different genres, there's a certain similarity to them. And that's what I like a lot in probably a whole bunch of the different indie comics I read, is that when there's something that is visually distinctive and I look at and I really get that feeling, this does not have the look and feel of any other comic that I'm reading. I like that. And that's something that is appealing to me when I'm reading the book. And that's what I like about this. And it's the same with some of the other GG books. They don't look and feel even like this. Like, you look at Mediterranea that they put out. That's another one that has a very different look and feel from this one, but it's different from other comics I'm reading also. And you're still reading Mediterranea?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean. That one's got that kind of like techno-Byzantine kind of thing going on, and it's, you know, the art style's a little more, not doing it right service, but more like more Humberto Ramos-y or something like that.
Yeah, that's a fair distinction.
But it's just visually appealing to me, and I really like it.
It's very clear that GG Studio does not have a house style at all. Each of their books is very distinct in terms of subject matter, in terms of the art style, tone, and execution and stuff, and I think that's something that's in their favor. You know, they should anything you get from them, and I recommend checking them out, is going to be well done. It's going to have a different take on things than an American comic, and I think that's a good thing. In this particular case, this one didn't click with me, but I've really loved a lot of their other titles and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of a company that I don't think they don't solicit books every month, and they're also books that are not going to necessarily be on the rack at every comic book store. So they're really something that you have to kind of look around for, but they're worth the look. You know, if you're into, you can come onto our forum too and ask about them, or, you know, we can point you to which ones to check out and stuff. But, you know, depending on what kind of things you like, there's some different kind of takes. Like, you made the good point that, you know, well, we've read like four or five different titles from them. Each one is very different from the other. You know, there's not a house style. There's not a house, you know, concept. They're not, you know, all one way or another, but they are each one of them unique. And I like that.
On the website, on the menu bar, on the podcast section or whatever, there's a weekly comics spotlight review list that has a page that's got all of our ratings for all the things we've reviewed. If you search on that page for GG Studio, you should find a bunch of the episodes where we've talked about them, because we've talked about Mediterranean number one, I think, Gore number one, Ethan number one, a number of their titles. So If you want to know what we think about those different titles, at least their first issues or whichever one we reviewed and stuff, you can check out our back episodes and listen for yourself. Because they've got some great stuff. They're a publisher that, you know, in the back half of previews, I always make a point of looking at what GG Studios has, Red 5, trying to think of some of the other ones. But there are quite a few that it's like, you know, if I'm on the fence and it's something that I may or may not get, and it's by one of these particular publishers that I think is doing a lot of really good stuff, that's going to push me into the yes, I'll get it. Whereas there are other publishers that have a little bit of a reputation for maybe not getting stuff out on time or not continuing with the title or something like that, and that might push me off. But again, the quality of the stuff coming out of GG Studios, I think, is really good.
You know, I think that's a good point. There's several publishers like that. You know, I would, as one of the larger ones in that camp, I'd put Boom Studios probably in the category of publishers that are small publishers, and I might not like every book that they put out, but it's not because of any lack of quality in the product that they're putting out. It's just that I might not click with the subject matter or the art style, or, you know, it's just there's not that click with every title that one of these publishers puts out. But when I look at the publisher in general, I kind of get the feeling that they've got pretty good taste in what they're choosing to green light. Whereas some of the other publishers, so I don't want to name, you know, it's like sometimes I'll see stuff and I was like, really? You know, just like I don't quite get the feeling that they have quite the same standards on what they're willing to publish. But, you know, GG and Red 5, and, you know, there's some other publishers, you know, they seem to have a good track record, at least with me, on what they're putting out. While I might not think every one is something that I'm necessarily going to read, they have good taste, in my opinion, on what they're putting out.
Yeah. So what's your rating for this?
I gave this one a 4.
Okay. Cool. So I've stayed current on DC. I've caught up through this week's Fear Itself. Still got some straggling Marvel comics I need to catch up on. I'm hoping to put a dent on my reading list this weekend. But yeah.
Yeah, I kept up on Flashpoint. I do need to get going on, you know, kind of finishing off my DC stuff. I got to get serious about that this week and next so that I'm ready to roll. I mean, the DC stuff hits the stands JLA and Flashpoint 5 come out as you're listening to this. If you listen to it when it first goes up on Monday, Wednesday is the day. And in fact, many stores are doing midnight release parties at midnight on Tuesday, you know, or, you know, essentially, you know, like the first minute of Wednesday, and they're getting those DC books out right then. I'm curious on, like, whether the shops are going to just, it's Wednesday, you can buy all the Wednesday comics here at midnight, or
I don't
if they're
know that
only going to sell.
They may only be able to sell the DC, and that may have needed special permission, because I think one of the deals with the Tuesday day early delivery was that books could not be sold prior to like 10 a.m. on Wednesdays. So to do something like these midnight deals, they may have needed to get special permission through Diamond, the publishers, or whoever for that to happen. So again, I'm not entirely sure, but it's possible they may only be able to do the DC stuff and people might have to come back later. But check with the stores, and it may vary from store to store.
Now, I'm going to be picking up Flashpoint. I am not convinced that I'm going to like drag myself out to a comic shop at midnight, but I will pick up Flashpoint at the shop on Wednesday. I didn't order it from DCBS because I really didn't want to be dodging the entire internet for a week waiting for that issue to get to me. You know, so I wanted to be able to just get it and read it, you know, so I've been staying all up on Flashpoint. So the last three or four Flashpoint titles I will get on Tuesday probably from DCBS. I'll read those right away, and then I'll read Flashpoint number 5 on Wednesday, and I'll be done with, you know, that that phase, and then I'll have, you know, an extra week to try to power my way through the rest of the closeout of the DC 1.0 or, you know, whatever.
I did order Flashpoint number 5 through DCBS, so I'll be waiting for it to show up in my shipment and stuff, but, you know, it shouldn't be too hard for me to avoid spoilers, provided people don't throw them in my face, which has happened a time or two. In other words, don't email me saying, wow,
I'll send you some email. It'll say, next week's episode. I'll say, hey, you know.
Hey, I've had certain things spoiled essentially through that way before. It happens, but, you know. Anything else for this week, or does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Batman Incorporated number 8 from DC, Captain America and Bucky number 621 from Marvel, and Executive Assistant Lotus number 2 from Aspen.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.